Author, historian, and Pulitzer Prize winner Doris Kearns Goodwin's latest work is Leadership in Turbulent Times. The book chronicles the journeys of four of our nation's presidents, Abraham Lincoln, Theodore Roosevelt, Franklin Roosevelt, and Lyndon Johnson. Through those histories, Goodwin explores questions of natural leadership ability versus developed ability, the relationship between ambition and adversity on leadership growth, and how leaders both perceive themselves and are perceived by others. Her bestsellers include Lyndon Johnson and the American Dream, No Ordinary Time, Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt, The Home Front in World War II, Team of Rivals, and The Bully Pulpit. It is a great pleasure to welcome Doris Kearns Goodwin. So great to see you again.
Glad to be with you again, too.
This
three
is great.
Times.
I know, this is Whoa. Three times. This is for we did it for Team of Rivals and for The Bully Pulpit and for this book, Leadership in Turbulent Times. So you've been at work on this for a while. What got you thinking about just this idea of leadership?
Yeah, I think what happened is that each time I finished one of my books, say I finished FDR and went to Lincoln, I'd have to move off FDR's books out of my study, go to Lincoln, then move Lincoln out to make room for Teddy. And I always felt a little guilty, like I was leaving an old boyfriend behind. So I decided, instead of finding some new guy this time, I decided, why don't I look at the four people, as you mentioned, and especially LBJ and civil rights and domestic stuff, knowing the war in Vietnam would cut his legacy in two, but knowing what he did in that area, and look at them through the lens of leadership. When I was in graduate school, we used to think about these big questions. It may sound pretty nerdy, but we'd go out at night and say, where does ambition come from? Does the man make the times? Is leadership born or is it made? And I've been lecturing on leadership for the last couple decades, but without really looking at my people just from that point of view. And I was at a college place one time, and a kid raised his hand. He said, you know, you're talking about leadership and how people lead when they get to the White House, but I'll never become one of them. It's too far away. It's remote. They're on Mount Rushmore. They're on the currency. So I realized if I started with them when they were young, when they first recognized themselves as leaders, when they were still going to screw up, then maybe young people and other people just aspiring to be leaders could follow their journey. It didn't seem already made before you know how it's going to end up. So that's how I began it. I learned so much about them when they were young that I didn't know.
One of the fascinating things about the book, though, is in learning about those early years, and that no one is on the same timetable, right?
Right.
As far as leadership and what we would consider greatness. By the same token, it certainly becomes apparent very early in their lives.
Yeah, that's what's really interesting. I think it's true for other people as well as for these people. At a certain moment, they find their vocation. There's a saying by William James, the philosopher. He said that at a certain point, you reach if you're lucky, something tells you this is the real me. This is the voice inside that says that. Lincoln is certain right away. I mean, when he's 23 years old and he runs for office that first time and he has to put out a handbill to say why he wants to have the job as the state legislator, and it's incredible already at the age of 23. He said, everyone has his peculiar ambition. Mine is to make myself such that I can be esteemed of by my fellow man and be worthy of their esteem. To think of that when you're 23 years old. And then he says he knows that he's only been in this town for 6 months of New Salem. They may not vote for him. And if so, he won't be very much chagrined because he's been so used to disappointment. But then he makes this amazing statement. He says, but I promise you, I'm going to keep trying even if I fail. In fact, I think I'll try 5 or 6 times. And then if I keep failing, it'll be too humiliating, and I promise I won't try again. I mean, that's amazing. So it showed that he had resilience from that first time. And he's going in already with the desire to do something with ambition that's beyond himself. Teddy admits when he runs in 23 that he's just going in for the adventure. Somebody comes to him, a political boss, says, why don't you run? And he doesn't have any thought, he said, of helping other people. But then through politics, he begins to learn about decrepit tenements. He learns about child labor. He's a police commissioner in New York, and he sees what the slums are like at night. And as a soldier, he's sharing his food and his shelter with other soldiers, and he develops empathy. He develops that desire to help other people. And I think FDR was a little later in coming to that. He was 28. He had been at Groton, at Harvard, Columbia Law School, not a particularly great student, not a very hard worker. And then he's at a Wall Street conservative law firm as a clerk. And somebody comes to him and said, would you like to run the Dutchess County seat in the Democratic Party? Not because he had shown the makings of a leader, but because his mother was wealthy and the Roosevelt name was good. It might attract Republicans because they think it was Teddy instead of FDR. But then once he gets on that trail, the barnstorming trail, he loved it. He loved listening to people. He loved talking, learning about their lives. He realized this is what he was meant to be, not that insulated kid from the elite background. And Eleanor said at the beginning, when he was just starting to talk, he wasn't very good, and he would pause between statements, and you'd think he was never going to go on. She was so worried. By the end of the campaign, he would go on so long that she had to come and bring him off the stage. And LBJ, just from the time he was little, heard his father as in the state legislature. He wanted so much to be a part of that life. He traveled with his father on the campaign trail. So the first time he comes on the scene, he's at a picnic, and they have people coming to speak for themselves who were running for offices. And there was a governor running who had given his father a job, and he wasn't there. He somehow hadn't made it. So they say, is there nobody here to speak to for Governor Rettenhoff? Little, not little, big even then, LBJ goes up to the truck bed, and he gives this stem-winding speech, and then he knows, this is what I want to be. So it's a really interesting thing to see them. But then they're going to have swelled heads. They're going to do badly. They're going to confuse. They're going to make mistakes. And you don't know that they're going to become what they become until much later.
So it is ultimately leadership that makes them good politicians versus politics making them good leaders.
I don't know. I mean, that's a really good question. I mean, I think what politics does is to expose them to a large number of people. That's why, you know, one of the things that saddened me about the 2016 election was that political experience was considered a liability rather than a strength. But for someone like Teddy Roosevelt or Franklin, all of them actually, I mean, Lincoln had been four terms in the state legislature. He was in the Congress. He ran for the Senate. The experience of being a politician means that you see people in other stages of life, if politics is done right, and you begin to identify with them and understand them. And I think that's what makes you a deeper leader than you were at the beginning.
Abraham Lincoln, Theodore Roosevelt, Franklin Roosevelt, and Lyndon Johnson. So I'll ask about why those four specifically. I mean, obviously, those are the four that you have studied.
They're my guys. I lived with them.
Those are your guys.
You know, after a while, when you live with these guys, you feel like you're waking up with them in the morning. You're going to sleep, not going to sleep with them. You're thinking about them when you go to sleep at night. And you feel like, this is, why am I doing this? I'm spending my whole life with dead presidents. And then I realized I wouldn't change it for anything in the world. My only fear has always been that in the afterlife, there's going to be a panel of all these guys that I studied. And every single one will tell me every single thing I got wrong about them or that I miss. And the first person to scream at will be Lyndon Johnson. How come that damn book on the Kennedys was twice as long as the book you wrote about me?
If you look at it just from a historical perspective, I guess the one thing that doesn't belong in that quartet would be Johnson, maybe, although you make a very good case for him in this book.
Well, clearly, I knew Lyndon Johnson, so I probably wouldn't have been a presidential historian without having worked for him. So I did have this personal relationship with him. And through that relationship, I helped him in the last year of his presidency and then helped him on his memoirs, was living with him at times down at the ranch. And I came to understand that however the war would always, always tear apart everything he had done, what he did domestically was extraordinary. And in those last years, all he was hoping that maybe he'd be remembered for civil rights. And when I think of the accumulation of what the Great Society programs meant, it meant that he didn't belong in that same category as them, but he belonged to be analyzed and to figure out why he was so successful in one area and perhaps not in the other. But think about it. Three great civil rights laws, ending segregation in the South, providing that right to vote to African Americans, fair housing, Medicare, Medicaid, PBS, Head Start, NPR, immigration reform, war on poverty. It's extraordinary. Any one of those landmark laws would have made a presidential legacy. So I wanted to understand how he was able to do it, especially in today's world. How did he get Republicans and Democrats to go together in the Congress? We need it so badly right now.
How much of that is ingrained, do you think? When we think of leadership, as you say, as they come, they make all kinds of mistakes and all kinds of horrible things happen. And these are not perfect men. And yet, when it comes to leadership and different types of leadership, they excel.
You know, just exploring this, I think there are certain leadership qualities that are inborn. I mean, for some reason with Lincoln, I think he was born with empathy. He just, even as a little kid, when there would be other kids that were putting hot coals on turtles to make them wriggle. He would go and say, this is wrong. He felt the pain in some way. And he obviously was born with a gift for language. With Teddy Roosevelt, he was born with a photographic memory and with enormous curiosity. FDR was born gifted with this natural, optimistic temperament, a confident, optimistic temperament. And LBJ just had unbounded energy. But for the most part, they all made themselves leaders. And Teddy Roosevelt wrote an essay once, two kinds of success. One who has natural talent that no one else can compete with, like a great poet, perhaps, or even a Lincoln at Gettysburg. But most people's success, and he thought that was him, are those that through hard, sustained work develop whatever talents they have to an extraordinary degree through the application of work. But then what they all went through that I think made them better leaders is they all went through terrible adversity. From what I've understood even about leadership, as Hemingway said once, everyone is broken by life, but afterwards some people are stronger in the broken places. And that happened to my four guys. Lincoln had a near suicidal depression when he was in the state legislature, and he hadn't been able to deliver on a promise to his constituents, and he thought his word was the chief gem of his character. And he'd also broken up his engagement with Mary Todd, so he'd broken his word to her, and it made him so sad. They took all knives and razors and scissors from his room, and his best friend came to his side and said, Lincoln, you must rally or you will die. And he said, I know that, and I'd just as soon die right now, but I've not yet accomplished anything to make any human being remember that I have lived. Amazingly, right, that he can think that way. So he comes out of the depression, finishes the state legislature, and then eventually gets a single term in Congress, runs twice for the Senate, loses twice, and then runs as a dark horse candidate for the presidency. But having been through that adversity when the war came, he was used to that, knowing how strength and resilience would somehow get him and the North through. And then Teddy Roosevelt is in the state legislature, and he hears word that his young wife has given birth to their child. The scars go all around. He gets a telegram. Then a second telegram comes hour later saying, your wife is dying and your mother is dying too. You must come home at once. And his wife was in childbirth. The mother was 49. She'd come to take care of the wife. She got typhoid fever. He got home in time for her to die. And then 12 hours later, his wife died in childbirth. And so depressed was he that he left the state legislature and he went to the Badlands. But he later said that experience of living 2 years in the West changed who he was. It was the best educational asset he ever had. He became a Westerner as well as an Easterner. He understood the land and the nature, which became his great conservationist legacy. And then, of course, FDR had his polio. I mean, he was an interesting character before that, but it deepened his empathy and his feelings about other people. When he set up that rehabilitation center at Warm Springs, he showed his vulnerability to the other patients. They would swim together in this giant pool, but he taught them not simply physical exercise, but he taught them how to get joy in life again. They'd have water polo and tag, or they would have dances at night in their wheelchair. They'd have cocktail parties, and they said they finally learned that there could be joy in life again. So he began to identify with other people to whom fate had dealt an unkind hand. And then Lyndon Johnson, of course, he's always sort of the outlier. He has a Senate loss in 1941, which shouldn't be on the par of these other huge losses, but he felt it was a repudiation of himself. And he goes into a depression, but he goes in the opposite direction. He loses some of the New Dealism that had started him into politics in the first place. He becomes more conservative. He goes after wealth and power. And it's not until 1955, when he's majority leader of the Senate, and he's very powerful, but he has a massive heart attack, and then he asks himself the same question Lincoln did in a way, what if I died now? What would I be remembered for? And then he gets civil rights through the Senate, and then he comes into the presidency, and that desire for his ambition to be something larger than just himself takes root in the Great Society and the civil rights laws. So they all go through that, and that was a really, I hadn't thought about all those things until I was exploring this.
Doris Kearns Goodwin is our guest. The name of the new book is Leadership in Turbulent Times. Ambition and leadership, how do they work together?
Ambition is huge, as our president might say. Without ambition, the drive for success, I don't think any of us can get anywhere. It's still a mystery where ambition comes from in people. I mean, whether or not it's a situation that's difficult in your family, or whether you're trying to best somebody else, or whether or not you've been privileged and you just want to recreate that privilege. I mean, they said about Teddy Roosevelt that he had so loved being in the center of attention when he was a kid that he always wanted to be the center of attention when he was an adult, so much so that he wanted to be the baby at the baptism and the bride at the wedding and the corpse at the funeral. So sometimes it's a drive to recreate what you've had. For FDR, that was partly true too. But somewhere along the line, as I say, the real transference has to take place between just that desire for oneself. And I think this is true for any of us in any field, and then wanting to do something that will make other people's lives better, expand their lives, or allow you to do something that stands the test of time. And that's the big change that happens.
So we talk about ambition. What about ego, and maybe even going further than that of a narcissistic? Right. I mean, everyone has, there's a certain ambition.
Absolutely.
And then to take it let's face it, any person who thinks that they can run this country has to have an ego, right?
Absolutely. A huge ego. There's no question about that. I think the real question is, and to just think they can be president of the United States, that they can take that responsibility, that people are going to want them to do that. I think the question, though, along the way is, are they willing, as they're going up that journey, to acknowledge that they have limitations? Do they have humility? Do they have, you know, the ability to see when they're doing something that's wrong and grow from that experience? Because ego is going to give them a swelled head. That was true of Teddy Roosevelt when he was in the state legislature. He had this blistering language, and he was constantly going against his enemies, and it made huge headlines in New York. They loved it. But then after a while, he couldn't get anything done in the state legislature. So he realized that he had risen like a rocket and he was falling like a rocket. So he had to make himself less annoying to other people, less irritating, and less ego-driven. So I think that at some point, that ego is, it has to be huge. Even Lincoln, he somehow imagines that he's going to have a different life than he was shucking corn and cutting rails. And that takes a lot of ego to think, I can be something different from what I am. You can't get there without it, but then you have to be able to contain it as it goes along.
But doesn't this then go to what you just talked about? You mentioned it twice so far in our conversation, and that is empathy. Where, okay, you may have a healthy ego, but then life smacks you around a little bit, and you're brought down, and you have an empathic side to other people and to their plights because of what you have gone through.
I think it's maybe the most important quality in a leader. In fact, I think if I were to worry, and we can talk about this later, about what's happening in the country today now, Teddy Roosevelt said that the way democracy would founder is if people from different classes, sections, and races don't have any fellow feeling, which was the same thing for empathy, for the other people. They feel the other people are the other, something different from them. And that's when things split apart. That's when divides happen. And I think if a leader is going to be able to reach over class or section or racial lines, they have to be able to understand the other people's point of view and feel it. And that's from experience, or sometimes it just develops in them from these experiences that they had that were so tough in life. And it's somehow, you're right, it knocks you down. Like somebody said to FDR, how can you deal with all the pressures of the presidency? And he said, if you spent 2 years trying to wiggle your big toe, or if you tried to climb up the stairs as he did, one step at a time, hoisting yourself up until you got to the top, and then you were having a huge triumph, a celebration for this little victory, then you would have patience when you become a leader.
You look at how just the office ages a person. As an example, the Pete Souza book about President Obama, you look at the pictures in the first year and then in the eighth year. I mean, there you can see it each year of how it's taking its toll on the person. But that's part of it, isn't it? I mean, that's an understanding of the responsibility that you have as a leader.
In fact, I think the most important thing that a leader has to have, in addition to assuming that responsibility, is the ability somehow, in the midst of all that pressure, to reduce the anxiety, to find time to relax and replenish their energy. Or else, even if their facial things look like they've gotten older, their energy, their heart, their mind has to keep strong. And each one of my guys, except for LBJ, and he's always, as I say, the outlier, they were somehow able to find that time. We were talking earlier before coming in here that we in our 24/7 world feel so many people, we can't take time away. We have to have our emails with us. We have to have our cell phones with us. They understood what we maybe do not, that unless you get away from the pressures, you will not only age physically but mentally. So Lincoln actually went to the theater 100 times during the Civil War. He said when the lights went down and a Shakespeare play came on, for a few precious hours, he could forget the war that was raging.
Yeah. And then once too many, unfortunately.
Yes, if he'd gone 99 times, you wise guy, it would have been better. So anyway, and he got enormous relief from his anxiety by his sense of humor. I mean, he was able, in the middle of the worst cabinet meetings, to tell a funny story, and then everybody would relax for a few moments, and he too would. In fact, when they were making the movie Lincoln, I was able to persuade Daniel Day-Lewis and Spielberg to use my favorite Lincoln story. It had to do with the Revolutionary War hero, Ethan Allen, who went to England after the war, as Lincoln told the story. And the English wanted to embarrass him because they were still mad by putting a huge picture of General George Washington in the only outhouse where he'd have to encounter it sooner or later. And they figured he'd be very upset about the indignity of George Washington in an outhouse. But he came out of the outhouse not upset at all. And they said, well, didn't you see George Washington there? Oh, yes, he said. I think it was the perfectly appropriate place for him. What do you mean, they said? Well, he said, there's nothing to make an Englishman shit faster than the sight of General George Washington. So can you imagine if he tells one of these stories in the middle of everything for a few moments, you'll laugh. He said laughter was like whistling off sadness. Teddy Roosevelt exercised 2 hours every afternoon, every single afternoon, a boxing match, a wrestling game, or his favorite was a walk in Rock Creek Park in the wooded cliffs, and he made a rule, you couldn't go around any obstacles. So if you came to a rock, you had to climb it. If you came to precipice, you had to go down. So there's stories of people falling by the wayside, one after another. But the best is a French ambassador who came in his silk hat, silk vest, waiting to walk in the Tuileries, and he finds himself in the woods. He can't keep up with Roosevelt. They finally come to the stream. He says, thank God it's over. We'll go back. Then he said, judge of my horror as I saw the president unbutton his clothes and say, it's an obstacle. We can't go around it, so let's take off our clothes. So I, too, for the honor of France, took off my apparel. However, I left on my lavender kid gloves. It would be most embarrassing if we met ladies on the other side and I didn't have my gloves on. So these stories are, but Lyndon could never relax. When I was with him at the ranch, he had a pool, and we would presumably go swimming in the pool, but the pool was filled with floating rafts with floating notepads and floating floating phones and floating objects so that you could work at every moment. And he didn't want to go to the movies because it would be too dark and he couldn't talk. You know, he didn't want to read a novel. So it weighed on him even more because he couldn't relax.
And that's just the mind always going, right?
Exactly. You just have to, what Lincoln said is you have to change your mind to another channel of thought in order to be able to fully get some replenishing of energy.
When we vote in history, are we voting for leadership? Are we voting for the person that we feel will be the best leader? Or is that too often left behind?
I think it's the most important thing we should be thinking about when we vote for a candidate. And I think it is too often left behind. In the old days when the party bosses chose the people, you're pretty much voting for your party. And even now, you know, you're voting for somebody in a debate who said something's silly or zinging. You're voting for who has most money, who represents certain issues that you may care about, but you don't know whether he'll ever carry out those issues unless you understand their temperament and their leadership. You know, are you somebody, as we've talked about, with empathy? Do you have humility? Can you create a team where you can share credit and you can shoulder blame for that team? Can you connect to the people emotionally? Do you have a sense of being able to control your negative emotions? Think about these qualities that I'm mentioning right now. Do you keep your word? We know all of the people have come from somewhere before. Most of the time, they'd come from another political office until this last situation. But even with President Trump as a leader, we could have seen what kind of leader was he? What kind of teams did he build? Did he build teams? And you would know that about a governor, a senator. And if we could use that, and that's the way journalists could cover candidates, not just in a long magazine piece, but how we talked about them. Temperament finally got raised in this last campaign at the end, but it should be a central quality I think we look at in our leaders.
We spoke with Doris Kearns Goodwin in an off-the-shelf event with Northshire Bookstore. The name of the new book is Leadership in Turbulent Times. It is published by Simon & Schuster. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.